Well, somebody really, you know, will define a vote as anything. Yeah, this is my vote.
Well, good morning and welcome to the Wednesday, April 21st edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee. Today we're going to continue with House Bill 5019, which is the budget bill for the Department of Environmental Quality. We're in the process of agency program presentation. We're in the Water Quality Division. Mike Llewellyn, the Division Administrator, is here, and Rick Gates is here, the Laboratory Division Administrator. And why don't we go ahead and have those gentlemen up to continue from where we left off yesterday with the agency program presentation.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Rick Gates. I would like to start by briefly addressing the concern that was shown given the apparent lack of biological monitoring in the Willamette Basin. The slide you see that I showed you yesterday only depicted projects that we were either currently involved in or had completed. It did not indicate the projects that we have yet to be done. And as you will notice, we have a federal grant to start a project in the west slope of the Cascade Range that will begin this summer. And that will hopefully greatly contribute to our biomonitoring effort in the Willamette Valley. The other portion of the Willamette is tied to our continuation of the steelhead supplement that's part of the agency's Willamette package.
With Senator King.
Could you give me just a thumbnail of what you're doing on the West Cascades? My district is not, is like 40% of that highlighted zone. I need a whole presentation to tell me what it is.
What it is, this is a biological monitoring, and we will do a random selection on site. And we go in and do a biological assessment looking at the macro invertebrates, fish population, habitat, primarily in the smaller wadable streams on the west slope of the Cascades. And it'll be evenly distributed. I don't know the exact number of sites we're going to be doing in that area, and they haven't been selected as of this point.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
Does this mean that you're not doing any biomonitoring in the populated area of the Willamette Valley right now?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Mesley, you'll notice in the lower Willamette and along the Columbia, part of the steelhead supplement that we were given to the emergency board a year ago in January included three positions that we were going to rotate between the lower Willamette in the Columbia and the rest of the Willamette Basin.
Thank you. Any further?
The monitoring project that you just received federal funding for the West Cascades, the crest of the Cascades is approximately the western boundary of the colored area of the map, is it not?
The crest should be pretty much along the separation between the red and the green, the upper Deschutes and the Cascades.
So where down in the valley, is there some kind of a demarcation line that's a natural line there? Is it the river or is it?
No, these are, the depiction here is on the hydrologic unit in the Willamette Valley. And again, we're not all the way down into the where the actual main stem of the Willamette is on these, because these biological efforts are primarily up in the smaller tributaries.
Okay. Elsewhere. There's some sensitivity about the fact that we seem to be doing a lot of work elsewhere, but not in the Willamette Valley. Thank you.
If I can continue from yesterday, just briefly recapping, this slide depicts that the bulk of Oregon streams are the small first, second, and third order streams. And most of our ambient water quality network sites are located in the larger fourth and fifth order streams And when I'm saying water quality metrics, I think of the indicators that we are using for the water quality index. And these are lower down in the watershed, where there are integrated impacts of both point source and non-point source issues. And the issues center around overall water quality chemistry. As one moves upstream into the smaller third, second, first order stream, the impacts are primarily from non-point source and land use activities, and the issues change over from primarily water quality chemistry to issues that include more habitat, temperature, and biological issues. In using the water quality index to assess the status of Oregon streams and rivers, one can observe that approximately 50% of the streams are currently rated as poor or very poor.
Okay. Question, Representative Messerly.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if this is the right place in the presentation to raise this issue, but I just have a sense that there's overlap between the different agencies, forestry or whoever's in the uplands, agriculture, ODF&W and you folks, and water resources. Does it make sense that we try to, I know this is probably nothing we're going to do this session, but that we try to organize this thing to the point where you have a lead agency for different types of land bases? And I would think something like maybe the DEQ would be the lead agency when you get to the urban areas. You would start with agriculture when you're dealing with ag areas, like the forestry if you're in forest land, and have all the other agencies coordinate through that one agency with the type of data they're trying to collect and the analysis they're doing.
As we're talking about habitat and repairing vegetation and all this kind of thing, it seems to me like it's not very efficient for you folks to be analyzing and doing those kind of things. No forestry and ag do those kind of things. ODF&W does those kind of things. Are we all, I hate to call it a turf battle, but is there miscoordination there?
Mr. Chair, representing Nobly, we are trying to coordinate through the Oregon Plan. There's an interagency monitoring team in which we are coordinating our efforts on the coastal salmon issue. Generally, while it sounds like we are doing similar things, we do not go in and duplicate each other's efforts in the same areas. On the issue with forestry, if you notice, DEQ's monitoring is fairly low down in the rivers and streams. We do rely on the Department of Forestry for their data as they go up and do their own management assessment monitoring. We don't go up and duplicate those efforts. I'm not aware that the Department of Agriculture is doing any type of environmental monitoring at all, and I think they are relying on our data on that aspect and also the data on the Watershed Council. So while it appears that there's multiple agencies involved, we do try to not go over each other's same turf and redo the same work.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Follow up.
And I refer to Representative King's question yesterday about some of those monitoring points high in the Cascades. Are those your stations then, or are those forestry stations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, the stations are our stations, and particularly those stations that Representative King mentioned on the McKinsey. Those have been set up with us and the McKinsey Watershed Council that has requested that we set up those monitoring sites. Thank you.
Question, Representative King.
I understand the being careful not to duplicate, but I'm wondering if there is a, quote, team approach. I think that we were showing that maybe there is some advisability of team approach. We see that works, dealing with planning issues for cities where we just send in a disciplinary team. We talked about one yesterday, where it makes sense to have a forestry person, an ODF and W person be involved in, and what you're doing in this monitoring so that maybe they can better utilize the information or a modest adjustment to what you do might end up giving them huge dividends that they couldn't invest themselves. I'm wondering if there's a potential for team approach.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I think there is a greater potential for a team approach than we're using it. As I mentioned, through the Oregon plan, we are trying to do a team approach and involve all the agencies, and I hope we can expand upon that.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Marsh, Director of the Planning Lady. Representative King, I think there certainly is an opportunity to do more. What we're trying to do with the other agencies is to not quite duplicate, but to have a similar type of organizational effort as the Community Solutions Team that work in the development of both infrastructure arenas. And so that in many of the basins, I would not say all of them yet, where we are working on TMDL, for example, the various agencies do meet regularly to compare what they're doing and to try to, as I think we were suggesting, leverage each other's activities. We have not, at this point, formalized it to the extent that it has been in the Community Solutions Team, but I think if you look at efforts in the Rogue and elsewhere, the MPLA, I think that is happening.
All right. Is any way, as legislators or what's the government's office to do to try and encourage that to happen, or do you think that's left that the directors cooperating or not cooperating and what they can speak to?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, there has been, as I'm sure you're aware, a discussion going on during the session about the best way to organize the overall Oregon plan effort. And I think whatever lead organization that the governor and the legislature agree on, I think that there will be an appropriate place for what I would call regional team approach, where on each sub-basin, for example, that the affected agencies will get together more or less frequently, depending on the circumstances and needs of that particular region, and also on the partnering needs between both the state agencies and the local efforts, watershed councils, starting with the conservation district, and others, and as well as federal, which may be more or less intense depending on the degree of federal land ownership, federal officials involvement, and so on. But I do see that approach evolving, no matter what kind of overall structure is put in place.
Thank you.
In looking at the 10-year trending values of the Water Quality Index, there's been a distinct move towards improving water quality trends. This doesn't mean that everything is suddenly better, but it does indicate that we are making progress, at least with those 8 parameters that are considered in the Water Quality Index. And probably the good news from this slide is that currently, within 1997, we do not have any waters that are showing a declining water quality trend.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. That's good. Help me with the 8 parameters.
The 8 parameters, they are in one of the slides, pardon me, but they are temperature. Thank you.
Page that I can find it.
Page 21.
Thank you.
Temperature, dissolved oxygen, biochemical oxygen demand, pH, ammonia and nitrate nitrogen, total phosphate, total solids, and coliform.
Thank you.
Question
on the same. We don't know of any place that had declining water quality, but my understanding of the hottest spots with respect to nitrogen loading had to do with the limitations on monitoring sites, not how much nitrogen there might be out there. But as I'm speaking, I'm thinking that had more to do with groundwater than streams. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, you're correct. I believe that had more to do with groundwater. But note that we only have 102 water monitoring sites that are included in this, and we do not have a I think we believe we're covering about, somewhere in the range of 20,000 stream miles as opposed to the 114,000 stream miles that are actually out there.
Question from Senator Metzger.
Does that include the Willamette River?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, yes it does.
So you're saying based on those indexes that it actually has been improving during a 10-year period on those?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, no,
so it's not declining, so it's got to be...
It's either holding steady,
gotta be holding or improving.
Or it's improving. And this particular slide does not separate us from the land. This is general for all of us.
Yeah, because there's no red there. I mean, I'm
right.
Assuming that
it's not
it's no worse better. Than it was before.
That's correct.
Hmm, that's interesting.
While we don't have sufficient habitat data to perform a similar trend analysis, we can perform and take a quick look at a recent coastal stream survey at the status of a coastal habitat. As you can observe, at this point, only about 40% of these streams are rated as good for habitat conditions.
Sure. Question, Senator Tarno.
How recent are we talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarno, this would have been the studies that were performed in 1997 and 98.
Sure. Did you get your question answered? And then Representative Nestle and then Representative Johnson.
What is the length of all the streams you've monitored to come up to 40%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nestle, that's a difficult question to answer, and I don't have a specific answer for how many miles that represents. The way we do biological monitoring is we pull an area out and then randomly select sites in that area. It's a random distribution of sites. And I believe in the coastal range, we were looking at about 100 different sites in the coast range during these studies. But I cannot give you a specific mileage breakout on this.
That's your follow-up.
We had testimony last session that there was 7 times more quality habitat than we had salmon returning. Is there a trend that's developing there? And that's what I was trying to get to, 40% of the total streams that we were talking about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I don't know that we can say that there's a trend developing on that. I really believe we need some more time to see what the trend is over a longer period of time before we would start making that kind of assessment at this point.
One more follow-up. That you have rated all the streams, evidently, or at least a sampling of all the streams to come up with a graph such as this. We should be able, or the Department of Fish and Wildlife should be able to, someone must have the database that they can go back and evaluate how many, what is the potential for the habitat we have presently.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I believe the Department of Fish and Wildlife has more extensive habitat data on the areas in phase 3 study. Ours are just strictly a snapshot of the conditions at the sites that we were sampling. In a few more years, I hope we will have more of these snapshots to be able to address your trend concerns.
Representative Jensen, Senator Tarno, and then Representative King.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a little problem with the wording that is used in the... we go from good to moderate to severe. To me, severe as a word indicates that it's very, very bad. I don't see anything that's very, very good there. All it is, I don't know whether that is the condition, that is, that we go from moderate streams to very severe or to severe, and that we have the good but nothing that is very good, or or whether this, and I know I'm playing with words, or it seems like I'm playing with words here, but it seems, but I also think that as graphs like you have get out to the public, where they start looking at it and people start taking this material and building 20-second sound bites on it. And I'm asking, I guess, if to explain to me good, moderate, and severe, and whether or not there is some very good, and whether or not there's some kind of poor but not severe sort of thing. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, your point is well taken, and I believe it's probably a poor choice of wording on our part, and perhaps something good, moderate, bad would balance out the issues. What this chart shows is actually the stream sampling sites are relative to each other.
Yeah.
We aren't intending that something is extremely severe and horribly bad and it's only moderately good type of a situation. It's just strictly a good...
Okay, it's a three-index sort of thing, and you know, we're comparing between those three as such.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that is correct.
Okay. I understand the little thing, but I'm afraid that people may look at it and see this severe and nothing very good and make a wrong interpretation of that. And that's what my concern is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, your point's well taken.
Senator Charman has a question.
I do, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little confused. a moment ago, you indicated this recent sampling of that you acquired between 97 and 98, but the chart shows the sampling between 94 and 96, and I'm just wondering, have you seen no changes from 94 to 98?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tarno, this was part of a federal grant that had us working in the Coast Range for a two-year period, and I apologize when I said 90, if I left the impression that this was in a later time period that's shown on the heading of the slide, that this is strictly for the federal remap grant for the Coast Range study that we did during 1994 and 96.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman,
Representative King has a question.
I'm writing my note on that.
Pass on the question now.
The relative scope of non-point source problems becomes apparent when looking at the impaired water body list. Over 50% of listed streams are listed for temperature violations. Except for a few instances, temperature is affected by land use activities and non-point source issues, and not from point source discharges.
Okay, question?
I just have to ask this for the record, that you said land use activities, but you still evidently haven't broken out what is natural, the baseline for temperatures, because that seems to be a huge question that we continually run into.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, this is strictly comparison of, in the issue of temperature, what the temperature is versus what the temperature standard is. And it doesn't take into account any source of why, background. It's just a factual temperature measurement in the water, and what is that compared to the standard on this chart.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm really coming from the same point of Representative Jensen did earlier, that could be misleading. If we're talking about land-based activities, general society would take that to mean that that's how we're managing our land. And there's a huge component there, I believe, that is baseline that we, really the managers, have very little to do with. It would be helpful if we could, at some point, if we're not prepared to do that now, but can break that down to what the temperature, what of that temperature standard we're not meeting because of land management.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Mike Llewellyn, Division Administrator for Water Quality. Representative Messerly, the
obviously the issue of natural background has been a great concern. And as we get further into the TMDL program and look at these water bodies with more specificity, more monitoring information being collected in the TMDL process, I think one of the byproducts will be the ability to discern where temperature violations are due to natural conditions in the particular watershed we're dealing with versus the anthropogenic causes. I think what Rick's mentioning here is that this is strictly how many water bodies where we have monitoring information showing a violation of the standard. But your question is a valid question. Ultimately, when we get into these particular watersheds and get a broader database, we will be able to, hopefully be able to discern natural causes versus man-made causes and deal with that in the TMDL process.
I got a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up for Commissioner.
Where are we in our temperature standards with EPA? Have they ever adopted our temperature standards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, no, they have not. We turned in the temperature standard package in 1996. There's been a tremendous amount of discussion, particularly in the last 6 months, between EPA and the National Marine Fisheries Service. The process is that when EPA evaluates a state's promulgated standard for approval, it triggers consultation with the services. And they've had a tremendous amount of discussion between themselves and with us as a state. I think it's safe to say that NIMS in particular was very concerned about the 64 degree standard. They still felt it was too high. But I believe we're to the point now where the EPA will move ahead on approving the standard package. It's clear, though, in the part of the condition of their approval will be a need to get back to the table and discuss some of the information and scientific literature that NIMS was using to express their concern about the 64 degree standard being too high. So we're anticipating that June or July we should get an approval of that 64 degree criteria along with the other criteria that were turned in 1996. But I think the debate about what that criteria should be in Oregon and actually in the Pacific Northwest is far from over.
What is the temperature standards that NIMS is trying to reach?
Mr. Chair and Representative Messler, they haven't told us that. They basically what they have said is that they believe that 64 degrees, based on fish biology, biological needs of the fish, is at the high end of the range for ensuring that fish, particularly with chronic exposure to that level of temperature, are vulnerable to disease. That juvenile salmon in particular are vulnerable during their growth development at that high end of the range. If I had to guess, based on my discussion, I think that the number that they seem to center around in terms of comfort level is 60 degrees. But that's just been in staff discussions, and it hasn't been a formal position that they've taken.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
What is the low end? I know they have some concerns about water being too cold as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messler, I'm not sure. We've never had that discussion. At least I haven't been involved in discussion about the low end temperature.
Could you make available to this committee the criteria that NIMS is using and as well as the DEQ used to reach even the 64 standard? In other words, are we looking for the optimum survival, or are we looking for the what temperature the species can survive for short periods of time before it starts impacting them? Exactly how we reach that 64 degrees. I know there's a lot of people out there and I know we've talked about it before too, but I still think we need to continually keep talking about how that, just to make sure that it is a commonly acceptable protocol.
Mr. Chair, if I may answer the response, yes, certainly we'll do that. And actually, there's some additional information that we didn't provide you in the last session that I think would be useful in this debate. We have done some work to try to demonstrate the NIMS that, in fact, most of the time, most of the teams that are concerned that the temperature is below 64 degrees, and that on an annual average, that's a dominant kind of effect. It's obviously the issue in the warmer parts of the summer, and we've put together some charts also to demonstrate that even during those warm periods, the time during which the temperature exceeds 64 degrees is only during a portion of the day. And the argument we made in defense of the 64 degree criterion was that even during those periods of the day, there were likely to be places that the fish could find refuge at cooler temperatures. And in any case, it wasn't this continual stress at 64 degrees that was likely to be occurring in real life. So we can show that to you. The other point I just wanted to add to what Mike said is that if a stream is above the criterion because of natural conditions, it shouldn't be on this list at all. So our effort would be to winnow out, and we have winnowed out a few so far, but to winnow out those streams on this list that are there only because of natural conditions, so we can isolate for the impaired list only those that have anthropogenic sources. And that's part of what the sustainability analysis can do and our biennial monitoring and reporting on the COPD list.
Thank you. I can do one. He just raised another question. Mr. Chair, to ask.
What we need to do is just a finite number of questions and you have to use them. That's the way you saw
it working. You brought to mind, Marsh, that have there been any studies done as to if you have, say, the stream gets to 64 degrees, do the fish concentrate in pools that are 60 degrees, or at what temperature do they seem to naturally move to the cooler water?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any. Maybe you could have been put.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I'm not aware of the specific temperature number you're looking for, but I know there have been studies done by OSU folks that have pretty well documented that fish do seek out the cooler pools in times of the warming of the river.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Curious sort of thing, and perhaps say cooling of the weather, do they seek out warmer pools?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I honestly don't know. I would.
Representative Jensen, part of the problem has been cold water. If you look at the water storage behind the Cougar River Reservoir and the McKenzie system, the water coming out of that system is colder later in the year when fish normally would be using the water for spawning. And cold water has been such a problem that they had to put mixing towers in that dam and mix the warmer and the colder water to release it so it's moderated for fish spawning. So, yes, cold water can be a problem for fish. Interesting footnote.
We've started to discuss, DEQ is working to restore water bodies that are impaired for one or more reasons. I talked a couple of days ago about how Oregonians use water, and we've walked through now some of the tools that we use at DEQ to help with our water quality program. In order to make a real difference, these tools must be used in a coordinated manner. Both within DEQ and working with other state and federal agencies and private citizens, which is, of course, the central theme of the Oregon Plan. And DEQ is playing a very important role in the Oregon Plan. As you know, and many of you were deeply involved in the development of the Oregon Plan, we are embarked on a 10-year schedule now to develop TMDL for the water bodies that are on our 303D list. The basic approach under the Oregon Plan is for DEQ to work with comprehensive, locally driven watershed processes through watershed councils.
That's good, Jim.
I am wondering if some of the questions that we're asking of DEQ here are at least in some ways maybe a little unfair, in that DEQ is not doing the research on salmonids, and that they're relying on the material from other agencies or the federal government and the standards that are being established. And we are basically, the agency is basically monitoring and trying to live within some parameters. Is that correct, or are you more actively involved in the quote-unquote scientific research of the species?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, when DEQ does have the lead role in terms of promulgating water quality standards, whether they're for public health or aquatic life, including the salmon. But you are correct that much of the standard development in terms of the underlying research, where the numbers come from, is often developed by other agencies, whether it's federal agencies, fish agencies. Our job typically is to try to pull together various interests when we develop these standards, like we did with the temperature standard as an example. And, admittedly, you get a lot of scientists in the room, as I'm sure you're all aware. You can get a lot of different perspectives about what a particular, if you're kind of forced into adopting one number, the high range, the low range, where is that number? And ultimately, I think that is a policy decision that should be grounded, at least, in good science. So part of our role is to try to glean as much of that as we possibly can and move forward to the DQC with a rule that adopts these standards, and then that's approved ultimately by EPA. So we don't do really the underlying research necessarily on these standards, but our job is to try to pull together the best information we can from a policy perspective.
Just as a point of observation, I think it's at least for one member of the committee, as we get involved in these discussions, there's often a tendency for us to, for me, at least to take on or give the agency that happens to be here at the time the responsibility for things that they are not necessarily responsible for. So. I would ask your indulgence as I ask you more questions about these things.
Our role in the Oregon Plan is
Senator Turner.
Mr. McHenry, as you ask your local watershed councils to assist DEQ, do you make any funds available to those groups for helping out?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Turner, a lot of the watershed council work is funded by GWEB. However, DEQ does pass through funds under what's called Section 319 program of the Clean Water Act, which is limited by definition to non-point source activities. So we have provided watershed councils and others with 319 funding.
Limited non-point?
Yes, it's 319 is a section of the Clean Water Act, and it is limited to non-point source activities. But we do pass that money through. So as I mentioned, DEQ is working on primarily TMDL, total maximum daily loads, which is the program that is at the heart of our job under the Oregon Plan. As you may recall, the schedule for developing the TMDLs is a 10-year schedule that actually started last July. I'm sorry, July of 1997. When the 10-year schedule was envisioned in 1996-97, our priorities at the time were driven by two phenomena. One was litigation that occurred in 1986. There still is an outstanding consent decree that was entered into in 1986 that directed DEQ to develop a certain number of TMDLs in the state. We also, given where we were 2 years ago here in Oregon, put our priorities into the Coastal Salmon Restoration Initiative. So a lot of the TMDL work that we're focusing on right now is directed towards the Coho areas in Rogue and Umpqua, Tillamook North Coast. So what you see here now is a map of our 91 sub-basins that we tried to schedule for the 10-year period, given the priorities that we had at least 2 years ago.
Mike, does that consent decree apply to all of these streams in our state that are in water quality limited services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, no, it does not.
What streams does it apply to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, I'll try to remember here. I believe that what was driven by the consent decree was the Grand Ronde, the Umatilla, the Columbia Slough, which doesn't show up very well on this because it's actually a subset of, I believe, the lower Columbia, I'm sorry, the lower Willamette, the Tualatin Basin, which we've done a lot of work on, and I believe the Tillamook.
And those that were listed under the consent decree, you only listed delisted as the Tualatin, the CMBL?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, the Tualatin has some water bodies that have been delisted for certain pollutants, but one of the problems is when you develop a TMDL, let's say for phosphorus, today, you can delist that stream segment, and then if next year we find a water quality problem associated with bacteria on the same stream segment, it goes back on the list. So one of the things that we're trying to do under the Oregon Plan to avoid this pollutant-by-pollutant, stream-by-stream approach is moving towards doing TMDL on a watershed basis so we can deal with all these pollutants at one time.
My concern is the the language of the consent decree itself. It gives us a mandate.
Right.
And what is the time frame on that mandate under the consent decree?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, I'll have to verify this, but just off the top of my head, it was a relatively vague consent decree. It had to do with 20% of the water bodies that were on the 303D list per year. But recall, this was over 10 years ago, so the 303D list was relatively small at that time. One of the problems that we have is that as the list has grown, the old consent decree is not very clear on what our legal obligations are. However, there's been a second round of litigation here in Oregon on TMDLs, and one of the attempts that we're having in settling that litigation is to clarify what this 1986 consent decree really meant.
Under the 86 consent decree, Mike, are we still in compliance?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tarnow, I think that's a legal question. As an example, in the last month, there has been a 50-day notice under the Clean Water Act, a citizen suit, in the Tualatin Basin brought by the original plaintiffs in the 1986 consent decree, claiming that we are not following, at least for the Tualatin Basin, the provisions of that consent decree. But I think as far as DEQ is concerned, we are developing these TMDLs for the consent decree, at least some of these that I mentioned for the consent decree, but I think ultimately it's probably a legal question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, I think that we believe that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. I think that there undoubtedly will be some challenges like that, which we will hopefully be able to avoid by the supervening settlement that will incorporate the Oregon Plan into the overall litigation picture. And as long as we stay in step with the Oregon Plan, that should relieve us of liability. However, there are two sets of plaintiffs in this litigation, and the one that instituted the 1986 action, and they tend to be more rigid or stringent in their attitude about how well we're doing. So we can probably expect some additional litigation along those lines in the years to come.
My concern, gentlemen, is that if the Columbia Slough is mentioned in that 86 consent decree listing, along with the Grand Ronde, the Tillamook, and Tualatin, and I'm wondering, are we on target with dealing with the issues in those particular tributaries that was listed in the consent decree in 86? Are we okay? Are we dealing with those issues that are specified?
Senator Connor, we believe we are. We have submitted and had approved the PMDL for the Columbia Slough already this year. So that's, we regard that as off the list. That will come off the next list. We are close to that with the Grand Ron. We're making very good progress in Umatilla. Klamath, which is another one Mike didn't mention, we're also making progress on, although EPA itself has said we need to deal with the upper Klamath before we finalize the one that was in the decree. So there's good progress being made on all of these, and we think we'd be able to send any action.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the Klamath. Does the adjudication process for the Klamath right now have any play with the consent decree aspect of anything?
Sure. Senator Connolly, yes, it does. But in fact, that's one of the reasons why, although the original decree talks about the lower Klamath, that EPA and we now agree that we need, because of the contributions to the problems in the lower Klamath and the upper Klamath, we need to move on to do that PMDL as well. And that one does involve the potential trade-offs between order quality and order quantity that are being discussed in the adjudication.
As we get through the adjudication process and the Klamath, then that should enhance the opportunities for delisting the Klamath on the PMDL.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Mr. Chair, I thought that the Coquille and the Bear Creek were two other water bodies that were water quality limited. Is that, am I talking about something different than what we, and I'm going back, I think Senator Cardinal was referring to the 1986 or so designation.
I see they're quite a ways down the list as far as their target date.
What's going on there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Messerly, there are some sub-watersheds that were started prior to our moving to this larger geographic area into the Oregon plan, so those will move ahead. I'm just not, Bear Creek, I believe, is one that Lang just mentioned to me that I didn't mention as a part of the 86th consent decree. So there are some specific smaller watersheds in those parts of the state that will be turned in as PMDL before this larger.
And the Coquille, did it drop her out, or I know we did a study down there years ago.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure. I'll verify that with our regional office.
Thank you.
I've probably used the term PMDL a lot and perhaps didn't explain what it means, although I think many of you have certainly heard this before. The PMDLs are total maximum daily load, which is admittedly a jargon that comes out of the Clean Water Act. Essentially, what a PMDL is, when all is said and done, is the process to identify the sources of water quality problems in a basin that led to the listing on the 303D list. Then it's the process of identifying responsibility for helping clean up that problem through what is typically called an allocation. Point sources are allocated loads, non-point sources are allocated loads. And since the concept of allocating responsibility is focused primarily now on who's there, one of the issues that we will be working with watershed councils on is to make sure that there is reserve capacity for future growth. So that it isn't just the folks who are using the river today, the local watershed councils will need to discuss if somebody needs the river in the future, how that would be potentially allocated for future use. By addressing water quality problems and solutions on a watershed basis, all interests obviously have a legitimate stake in the solutions. Many different agencies and groups are involved with developing these TMDLs, the Water Quality Improvement Plan. This shows that protecting water quality requires extensive partnering and coordination, and the Oregon Plan approach is providing exactly that. On the last year, DEQ has worked a lot with, in particular, ODA and ODF on putting together memorandums of agreement to clarify and spell out our respective roles in the development of these TMDLs, since obviously forestry and agriculture have lead roles with their constituents in our job is to try to take the products from the Forest Practices Act and or the 1010 planning process and meld them into a comprehensive TMDL. We also are providing, as Rick mentioned, a lot of water quality data and training to the local watershed councils, since they're doing a lot of work in characterizing the various water quality issues in their watershed.
Chair recognizes Senator Tarno for recognition of the guests and also President Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to welcome the Mayor of Coos Bay, Joanne Bridger, and her husband, Lawton, to our committee hearing this morning.
There's another very important person there.
And the grandson.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to point out that this is Mayor Bridger, and he's also the Chair of the League of Oregon Cities, President of the League of Oregon Cities. Welcome.
Welcome.
As I've mentioned, TMDLs require all contributing sources to help in the restoration of the impaired water. This is just a sort of a graphic to try to describe what a TMDL ultimately might look like in terms of the concept of load allocation. This is an example for a phosphorus load allocation in the Tualatin, which is one of the very early TMDLs that DEQ developed. The process for arriving at these allocations are first by determining how much load a river system can take to still meet water quality standards, and through the local watershed council discussions in allocating that responsibility among the various entities here. Perhaps in anticipation of a question, the phosphorus issue here in the Tualatin is primarily a summer low-flow problem. So you'll see that because the wastewater treatment plants actually are the larger load of water in that system during the summer, they got a larger proportionate share of the loading. If this was a reverse, as an example, where perhaps we're talking about a wintertime situation related to a water quality problem, it's likely that the non-point sources that are land-based or runoff-based would have a larger share, because the point source wouldn't necessarily be a significant contributor for that situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the solution to this? Is impoundment and increasing the summer flows the primary solution, or isn't it true that there's also a high base line for the phosphorus in the water in that area too, from the groundwater?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, essentially the way this allocation process works is that, I think the easiest is the wastewater treatment plant. They get a load expressed in pounds per day of phosphorus. They then have to engineer their wastewater facilities to treat phosphorus and remove it. For agriculture, that load is then given to ODA. They develop a 10-10 plan to figure out among their constituents how to develop farm plans or implement the 10-10 planning process to get to that load. And then forestry looks at their site-specific rules for phosphorus.
We have several questions. Representative King, Senator Tarno, Representative Morgan, and then colleagues, we have a session today at 10. And it's my hope that Mr. Rowland can present the next five slides before 5:10. So if you'll keep your questions.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw mine for the sake of brevity.
It's gone, and a question for Ben.
I'm not going to name mine, actually. I'm not convinced that summer is the right statement. I remember driving over 12 this spring and looking down and kind of seeing that pea green color, which to me indicates there's bloom going on. And so I think, anytime the grass is starting to grow, probably the drought is cooking. But I'm dumbfounded to see that much wastewater treatment on a river that's, from my mind, clearly incapable of carrying much of a load, because it's such a long, flat, slow river. I just had assumed that they were just getting a whole bunch of urban fertilizing bloom in there. And, boy, that doesn't seem like the right river to really load up with a lot of fruit. What cities are putting into there?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, the treatment plants that I'm familiar with, maybe Rick has been out there a lot more than I have, are primarily the Unified Sewerage Agency facilities, I know, on Rock Creek, and I think they have a couple of other.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe there's 7 sewage treatment plants in the Fallen Basin that feed into that, covering everybody from Hillsboro, Forest Grove, and other cities on down.
This is a take-home question, so this one's going to be real fast. But I was wanting to go back to the 319 funds, and I was curious about over, say, the last 5 years or so, how much funding you had gotten from the federal government that came into that program here at the state, and how you dispersed that. And I was wondering if you could give me an accounting of that for the next time.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and colleagues, we will hold our questions until Mr. Rowland has gotten through the next part.
Results from the Tualatin, at least over the last couple of years, are showing a declining trend in the phosphorus concentrations, although we still obviously have algae growth problems. But this is a slide that shows, I believe, at the Stafford Bridge, the concentration of phosphorus since May 1990 to today. Over the past biennium, DEQ's 19 positions that we received for the Oregon plan have been very busy working with the watershed councils as well as others to get improvements underway related to the Oregon plan. This is a more specific map of where DEQ staff are working right now with watershed councils. In most cases, we're working on TMDLs themselves that are on our schedule, but we also, in anticipation of TMDLs that will be coming based on our schedule, start to do some pre-work with these watershed councils, particularly related to getting data and information ready to go. So once we get into the TMDL process, we have the ability to start with some factual information.
Are soil and water conservation districts involved in TMDLs also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, absolutely.
So there's a kind of a parallel thing going on here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, a lot of the soil and water conservation districts are working actually more under the 10-10 planning process with the Department of Agriculture. But as using the Grand Ronde as an example, DEQ is pulling together not only the 10-10 plans, but urban issues and forestry and federal land. So the soil and water conservation districts tend to focus on the 10-10 planning process, but through that involvement are tied into the overall TMDL program.
So that means you only have to answer half of her take-home question.
We also are trying to obviously leverage and get some synergy out of other environmental planning processes that are underway here in Oregon to help accelerate our TMDL schedule. DEQ staff, for example, are working with the Tillamook Water Quality Improvement Plan process that's driven by the National Estuary Program in the Tillamook Bay. This was a program that was already underway. There was a lot of information already collected. There was already a local group established for that National Estuary Program. So the TMDL process didn't have to start from scratch. We could just go in and start working with those folks. The same can be said for DEQ's work with the Lower Columbia National Estuary Program, which is actually a bi-state program between Washington and Oregon. To the degree that water bodies in Oregon, either tributary and or the main stem of the Columbia, have to be dealt with in the 303D arena, we can use the already existing program and the NEP to help get that process underway. And when we come back at the work session, I'll be discussing the policy package related to the continued funding for the at least Oregon's half of the NEP program. So in closing, Oregonians have a long and proud tradition of caring about our rivers, streams, lakes, coasts, wetlands, and estuaries, and our groundwater resource, and much progress has been made, but obviously there's still some work to do. We will continue to work collaboratively in a coordinated fashion under the Oregon Plan to protect these resources. We hope that we don't lose ground on the progress that's already been made with point sources in particular by continuing to invest and reinvest in the infrastructure that's in place and moving now to work with other agencies on our non-point source programs and address those pollution problems as well. So that's it, Mr. Chair, and I'd be glad to answer any other questions.
Questions? The rest of the mission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out in our discussion on the Clawson River, I believe this is true, that the USA, the Unified Sewage Association, has actually won several national awards for being a very, I mean, the slide shows there, had some real serious problems, but they've really done an excellent job in dealing with their population. And as I discussed with them last week, their big problem is getting more water flow into the river. And I just wanted to not leave other impressions here.
Well, I think the slide is simply in relative terms. With the load is not nothing qualitative or quantitative about that load, just what the allocations of the load are. Any other questions? Colleagues, let's talk about schedule for just a minute. We are going to be moving next week into all that staff discussed schedule. We're going to be moving some bills out next week.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tomorrow we're going to cancel our meeting. We've had a scheduling change, so there'll be no meeting tomorrow. Beginning Monday, we'll wrap up DEQ's public hearing with a presentation by Agency Management Services Administrator Helen Muttridge. Then we're planning to do work sessions on the Land Use Board of Appeals and the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries Tuesday and Wednesday. And we will have a hearing on Bill 1109 on Thursday and finish up any additional DEQ material that we need to discuss. And then the next 2 weeks following that, we will get into the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Gorge Commission, Columbia River Gorge Commission, the final two agencies to be reviewed by this by the subcommittee.
The schedule is such that and the topics left are such, such that we probably will have a lot of questions. I know the Department of Fish and Wildlife has been the focal point of a lot of controversy. I want to remind the community we do need to get through some of that substantive stuff as quickly as we possibly can, since we're basically a budget committee, not a substantive. And the same will be true for the Gorge Commission issue. That's one that's been extremely controversial at times. We need to move through that budget in 2 days. So we're going to ask the committee to stay on track, on focus, try to limit our questions as much as possible to the financial considerations, so that we end up beginning at the May 24th area, actually May 17th area, completed work program for the budgets that we were here, and so we can move right into work sessions on all the remaining. The co-chairs have asked us to move along in a thanking fashion, and we've been pretty indulgent about asking committee members or allowing committee members to go anywhere they want at this interval, because I believe this is a great place for people to learn about how agencies operate. Our questions, I referenced
it. Notice that when you were saying move along quickly, you were kind of looking down this end of the table, and I want you to know we're very sensitive down here.
Actually, it's not the committee members that are responsible for meeting the time requirements of the committee. It's the committee chair, so I'm really thinking that I need to keep this focus separate. Any other business to come before the committee? Seeing that, we have about 10 minutes to get to our closed session, but we are in adjournment. Go meeting tomorrow.